and welcome to a new episode and indeed a new series for this Challenger City podcast. Now, over this coming series, what you're going to see is we've pivoted away a little bit from this focus that we had specifically on Toronto during Series 1, mostly because we got lots and lots of people from all over North America, a little bit of Europe and some other places around the world really interested in how they could make their city more of a challenger. Doesn't mean we don't love Toronto, it just means we wanted to broaden this thing out. So we'll go into that in more detail as we go through the series, but I thought of someone who would be a perfect guest to kick us off. And he's not very far away from Toronto, and indeed he has lived in Toronto quite recently. But Paul Kalfleisch, he got introduced to me as the co-author of a book called Joy Experiments. We had a great chat, I read the book, I raced through it, it was fantastic. But really it looked at how we can focus on making these mid-sized cities true challengers, embracing their distinct identities rather than trying to mimic these larger urban centres, which was kind of the genesis of challenger cities in the first place way back when. So in this conversation with Paul, he's going to share his fascinating journey from the world of brand strategy when he worked at BlackBerry through to some of the work he's done in the Waterloo region. Now, if you're not from Canada, Kitchener-Waterloo might not be a place that you're aware of, but it's really a fantastic example of the mid-sized city full of creative intersections where they attract top talent, they build a strong sense of community, and Paul and some of the work that he's done in that area really looks at some of the magic that can come from public art installations to the power of simple things like chairs being something in the public realm that brings strangers together. And what we'll get to is this way that Paul framed it, where a lot of the time when we're talking about cities, we're often talking about live, work, and play. Paul flipped that, and he talked about play, work, play, live, work. And I thought that was something so simple but so important when we think of the future of better cities for like growing up in, growing old in, raising a family in, and whatnot. So whether you're a city planner, an urban enthusiast, or just someone looking to make a difference in your community, I think you'll love this episode, and hopefully you'll really enjoy this series as we keep going in. So without further ado, here is an episode with Paul Kalfleisch, the author of The Joy Experiments, and let's dive in. Paul, thank you so much for kindly giving up some of your time to have a chat with me today, especially as we met by someone saying, you have to talk to this guy because he wrote a great book, and then you kindly gave me a digital copy of your book, which I sort of devoured very quickly. We'll come into that, but I'd love to get us started with you just talking a bit about yourself and how you became this guy that is sharing really interesting thinking around urbanism and the future of cities.
Well, it was certainly not a straight path. I'm not an architect. I'm not an urban planner. One could argue that I have no business doing what I'm doing. I a few years ago, I saw a talk with Richard Florida, and he mentioned that he considers himself a very lucky individual, and lucky people find themselves in the middle of things they have no business being in the middle of. And that, in fact, is what that's in fact the value they bring to the situation. And I thought that was so good, I said I'm going to start borrowing that and using that. My background was primarily in marketing. For 10 years, I was vice president of global brand strategy and advertising for Research in Motion, BlackBerry. And I've also done worked in other agencies on the agency side. And I primarily was good at working at placing, understanding what rules brands play in culture, and then figuring out how to place brands in the culture. And that gave me a great background in just focusing on what goes on, how do people organize themselves, what bonds people, what makes this city different than the other. My career at Research in Motion ended, and I lived in Waterloo region, which is part of Ontario where BlackBerry and the University of Waterloo is. And I was asked by someone, an architect who was working with the region, to if I could develop a strategy for how to design public space that would make the region far more appealing to the world-class talent the region needs as it ventures further and further into the innovation economy. And he asked me to do that for a couple of reasons. One, as I mentioned, my background in understanding culture and how things work and how people sort of align themselves. But also because having worked at Research in Motion, and I knew just how hard it was to hire people to come to the region. And I had traveled to most of the cities that the region competes against. So I knew where the bar was in terms of a city people wanted to live in. And so that those reasons were what I got, why I got involved in it. Plus, I tend to be good at taking big, fuzzy ideas and shaping them and articulating them in a way that makes them more real to people and get people willing to buy into them. So all those things sort of gravitated together. And I did a lot of research, did a lot of traveling, and developed a strategy called Creative Intersections, in which the idea was to take some of the world-class activity that's going on in the region, hand it over to installation artists and create public art in public spaces that allows people to play with this great innovation, and then therefore start to identify that type of activity as part of their city identity. While at the same time, people who are thinking of coming to Water the Region to work would look at the region and say, hey, these people tend to really appreciate the cool stuff that we do, that I do, and they kind of, you know, love us. And so I think I will kind of move there. That strategy was extremely well received. And then the regional government placed it on a shelf, and that was kind of the end of that. Except
sounds
for
a familiar one story.
I'm not picking on that region. I think that happens far too often everywhere. Except for one real estate developer in the region by the name of Scott Higgins at Hip Developments. And he called me up and said, hey, I'm building a 2-acre public square plus condos plus event hall plus an old limestone warehouse buildings and factory buildings. And I want to use the creative intersection strategy to make this place a place that invents the community for the next generation. He said, how do I do that? And my answer is, well, jeepers, I don't know. I mean, I just wrote the strategy. I don't know. I guess you hire me to consult for you. That led to, 7 years of working on that and many other projects with Scott. And that sort of moved me into this whole field of what's the social purpose of cities? What's maybe perhaps the new value of cities as we are struggling with our social division, et cetera, et cetera? And how do we use cities to bring people together? How do we use cities as the starting point for healing our social divides? And a lot of Scott's work was focused on this idea of the community aspect of real estate development. I often say that Scott Higgins is a city builder first, real estate developer second, as opposed to some who are real estate developers who are also city builders sometimes. Scott comes at it from another perspective. The book that you sort of mentioned, The Joy Experiments, really started out as Scott one day saying, I want to get a manifesto to explain to community leaders and city stakeholders why I go further than I need to on projects. Because, a real estate developer doing more than what they should for the community makes people extremely suspicious. What is exactly is he up to? If he's doing good stuff for us, oh my God, that's really scary. So we worked on that for a bit, and manifestos tend to be kind of like corporate poetry, and as long as they can fit on a coffee mug, they're good or something like that. And none of that was really cutting it. And then I suggested that maybe it should be a book, which then led to me starting to draft it. And then at a certain point, Scott very graciously said, well, you know, a good chunk of these ideas and a good chunk of what we're doing comes from your brain. So why don't we co-write this? And that led to the Joy Experiments, which the subtitle is, as I hold the book, Reimagining Mid-Sized Cities to Heal Our Social... No, see, I get that wrong. Okay, let's try that again. Reimagining Mid-Sized Cities to Heal Our Divided Society. Now, we started off thinking the book should be about ideas for drawing in world-class talent to cities, and it was more of an economic development idea. But the deeper we got into all the work we were doing, we realized it's really a societal thing and perhaps socioeconomic. And in the 7 years, 8 years that we've been working together, the pain of a divided society just seems to get stronger and stronger, and mm-hmm. the message that we carry in the book seems to be becoming more and more relevant.
I feel like since we met the first time, which wasn't very long ago, I've been in so many people's houses and I've spotted that book sitting on or underneath coffee tables.
Wow. How come I'm not richer than I am already? Something's gone wrong.
I think you might have to have a word with the publisher. but it's interesting how I keep seeing that book pop up in different places.
Mm.
There's a thing that you said in our first chat where everyone loves the line, and I use it myself all the time, of like people living, working, and playing. And you flipped it the other way of playing, living, and working.
Yes.
And it was like one of those things like, I'm kind of pissed off because I wish I'd thought of that. And the way you articulated that of like designing cities for play and for joy, I think is something that gets lost in the realm of people who are more classic urbanists, who probably come at it with a very good sort of academic schooling, a very good sort of technical education, but they sometimes miss the piece that the accidental urbanist maybe understands a bit better than they do, or just differently about what makes cities really important. Like, how did you get to that point of just going, hang on a minute, it's play?
I think a lot of had to do with the idea that society is in such a state of withdrawal or a state of fear and loneliness and distrust that you just can't sort of say, hey, let's just get together and figure out what we have in common. And that should be easy, right? And then we'll go from there. You almost have to disarm people to start to get them to sort of see what they have in common. And public play does that. Public play has this way of getting you to, you know, whether it's, you know, we all need to step on a certain square on a piece of playing field to make a certain sound. And if we all do it, then next thing you know, the lights go off. And before you know it, we are collaborating and we didn't know we were even trying to. And we're having this moment of some fun. And then we start to realize, well, geez, when's the last time I had fun with someone who doesn't look like everyone else in my algorithm? You know, this is very odd and interesting. And it disarms you. And I can give other examples of that. So that aspect of play was one of the things that we were, we knew we wanted to create those kinds of moments in the work that Scott was doing with Hip Developments, and that we were seeing working in other places around the world. The other aspect of play is that when you think about it, it's like the most complex social activity humans do. Play is where we learn to collaborate and see that actually our differences are actually an asset, not a liability. Play is where we learn compassion for team members. Play is where we learn to celebrate together, and play is where we learn curiosity and creativity. Someone recently gave me a book called The Creative Lives of Animals, and there's a whole chapter in that book about play. And, you know, play is how animals learn to hunt. Play is where they learn how to protect themselves, and play is where they learn how to actually collaborate. And I'm not just talking about dogs and cats. I'm talking, in the book, they're talking about insects doing this. So the message, you know, you come away from that is, as living beings, we are hardwired for play as being an important part of how we evolve. And when we dismiss it as frivolous, we do ourselves no favors. So those were two, you know, and when you say, well, play is how we collaborate and how we break down barriers and how we learn to trust and see differences as assets and all this stuff. These are all the things we need, right? If I did that list without calling it play, you would say, yes, those are the things we need to get better at. Well, in actual fact, they're found in play. And when you do public play, that's where you actually start creating the roots of community. And when you devote public spaces to that sort of thing, you give community a sense of place, a sense of geography, which is, I think, really, really important. Because if you look at the way the world is right now, our societal behaviors are getting more and more divorced from physical spaces, physical geography, as it were. We live more and more in a virtual world, and if the tech oligarchs had their way, we would live in an even more virtual world. And we spend more times in our backyards, or, you know, binge watching and on Netflix, and doing more of our supposed social activities through social media. And we're losing this connection between physical space, physical sense of place, and what we call community or society. And that's one of the reasons why we're sort of all sort of disoriented. We're not quite figuring how we fit into our own spot, much less how somebody else fits into something, much less how we ever fit together into something. And cities that know how to play, that's where we start this healing. And then, you know, the book was, you know, Heal Our Divided Society Through Cities. It starts with cities. It's not going to start at the national level, because national politics and national organizations, I mean, quite frankly, dividing us is built into their DNA. That's how they compete, and that's how they succeed, is by dividing us. It's not going to be some holy message delivered from Davos, Switzerland. We are going to start the process of healing in our cities, and we're going to start it in figuring out how to ways to make us engage and interact on the streets, because we'll change the world by how we change cities.
What did, in the book, you talk about some of that in the likes of Cambridge, mm-hmm. and some of those like art installations, or some of those things that were part of hip developments, and the impact that that had on people and how they saw them and how they interacted with them. What was the highlight for you in some of that? Like, what things have you seen in your own backyard effectively that give you hope for healing those divides?
There is one piece of public art that in Cambridge at the Gaslight District, that is a hip developments project that Scott still manages and is growing it to its full potential. There were three pieces of public engagement installations created, public art, if you could call it that. All three had something to do with the Grand River that runs right through that part of Cambridge, an area called Galt. And it's one of the few areas that the Grand River actually touches the community, and especially in a very tight urban space. And yet there were no real stories about it. Like, we're not really good at telling our story. So, you know, I really strongly felt that we should start finding ways to tell the stories of the Grand River. And so we worked with a faculty member of the University of Waterloo School of Architecture by the name of Philip Beasley, who creates a thing called Living Architecture. And it's And it's using, you know, science, technology, engineering, arts, math, all to create sculptures that represent how nature organizes itself, how nature builds strength. So it's sort of a web of weaving, and it looks plant-like in a way, and it's full of lights, and it's just stunning work. And if you look up Meander in Cambridge, Ontario, you can see pictures of it. And that's the name of it. I wanted to use that to tell a story about the Grand River in Cambridge, and for people to feel like, oh, this is actually part of our community. Hip Development's contracted Philip to build this piece. It's a very, 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 very large piece of living architecture. Certainly, I think the largest in Canada, and I'm not sure how it fits in the world. And it's permanent, and it's in the hall called Tapestry Hall. And it's stunning, and it is impressive. And when people walk in, they whisper when they talk, because it's magnificent in terms of its beauty. And you really do get the sense this is a view of nature. Scott and I always had this dream that we would create a performance of it, like an 18-minute performance with music and sound and lights, and that people would come and just lay on the floor. Promise was we would do these and they would be free. You didn't have to buy tickets to come to these things. You could come as, you know, however often they're scheduled, and I'm not quite sure what the schedule is for them right now. And I always wanted to just have, we called them pillow nights, you know, bring your pillows, bring your blankets, lay on the floor and just enjoy it. And, you know, that actually finally did start to happen. And seeing those pillow nights where, you know, the people enter into this hall, it's dark at night, and they lay on this floor, and this incredible performance created by Philip and his team with this amazing soundtrack that we worked on with a fellow from, I think, Portland, Oregon. World-class stuff. But so emotionally powerful, and people just, they get into it. They lay on the floor and they lay there for 20 minutes and just stare at it. And to me, that was like it's achieved all that I hoped it would. And then one day, someone who was watching it came up and after and pointed to one part of the Meander sculpture that sort of throbs with light throughout this performance. And she said that, to me, that's the heart of Cambridge. That is the heart of us, and we need that heart. I thought, wow, this is now, it's beyond what I expected and what I hoped for. And to create that type of experience so that afterwards people just start talking about it, and they're talking to people, not that they know, just people who experienced it with them. Mm-hmm. That's the start of community. But it's starting the community with our own stories. It's not, we're not borrowing stories from anyone else. These are our, we are creating our own stories. And I think that's just wonderful. And, you know, you ask for a highlight. And to me, that's just I still love going down there just to experience, just to be there, to sit there and look at people laying on the floor who would never dream of doing something so weird.
I love it as an example because it's basically unquantifiable. Mm-hmm. You can't put a value on the impact of somebody laying on a pillow looking up at that piece of art.
Yeah, you know, people will say, you know, oh, well, I mean, that, sure, you know, you spend blah, 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 and look at this. Sure, you can do that. But what about, you know. Another example is in the public square, we have a bunch of spun chairs. Now, if you look up spun, as in you know, spun a web, spun chairs, these are Herman Miller chairs. They're, you can see, yeah, see them at Design Within Reach and various other places. And I've seen them for years and years and years, but always in, you know, they're cool looking chairs and they're always in an office setting or something.
They look slightly uncomfortable, but it's kind of like a
spool, only spool that kind of is lopsided and you kind of roll around in it. And when you roll backwards, you swear to God you're going to fall over and break your neck, but you don't. But they're scary as heck in the process. I was in San Francisco and in Golden Gate Park, and they had closed a road, and they had all these installations on this road, some of which are the most coolest looking areas to sit with a coffee table, and designed by a great, you know, cool hip designer with like two people sitting there, both of them on their phones, like, you know, okay. But yeah, 50 yards away, someone had dropped like 12 sponge chairs. And oh my God, everyone's in them. They're rolling around. They're screaming. They're embarrassed, but they're laughing at the person beside them that's embarrassed and I looked at it and went, oh my God, I can't believe I never thought of sponge chairs outside, because they're made of resin or something. So there's nothing that happened to them. And B, I was witnessing everyone coming together and discovering they had something in common. And what they had in common was human imperfections. We're all imperfect. We're all being silly right now. We're all exposing our frailties. We're exposing that I'm scared, but now I'm laughing. I'm laughing at you only because you're laughing at me. And we're actually not laughing at each other. We're laughing together. And I thought, this is an amazing moment of building the human community. And so I came running back and said, we've got to get sponge chairs. So we got some sponge chairs, and they're always a hit. I mean, you always see people. There are big events, big movies played outdoors at Gaslight. And when the movies are over, you know, most people go home, but there's always a pile of people and kids and adults too. It's always kids and adults. It's never just kids. Kids start it, but then adults get into it.
That's
rolling around on these sponge chairs. And then you get someone who's like turns them over and tries to figure out a different way to go, you know, play with them. And I just think they're the most very, very simple way of achieving the community of humanity, just by a handful of sponge chairs.
I find chairs a fascinating thing because so totally low tech. I was walking past a park today, and like quite a nice park in London. Like, it's a nice sunny day. The sun's basically not come out here in the last 2 weeks. Nowhere to sit in the park, and like, you're not going to sit on the grass in November because it's going to be damp. And it just felt like a really sad waste of a nice space. And I know there's been things like the chair project in Toronto, which was literally just putting out folding chairs in public spaces and people will sit on them. I was in Merida in Mexico earlier in the year, and they have all over the city, they call them conversation chairs, but they're two chairs that are quite close together and they face each other, and it's all designed so that people sit and have a conversation. I'm sure they exist in other cities too. But people in those chairs are not on their phones. They're like talking to one another. But it's such a basic thing that I feel like we've totally overlooked. We'll get obsessed with the architecture, but we lose a little bit of the fun of the space itself. And I think that's what you write about so clearly.
Yeah, I think you're talking about like the evolution of the park bench. Surprisingly, we still invest a tremendous amount of money in park benches that are regimented like military lines. You sit there to be quiet, because they're all in a line. So there's no way you can talk to anybody because you're just one single line of chairs. I've even seen park benches placed in a park with their backs to the activity that's taking place, right? You know, because, well, actually, I don't know why. You know, park benches are great. Parks are great. But both of those are kind of currently designed from an era when parks were meant as a place to withdraw from the hectic urban life and the noise and all of that. But we are now in an age where society is completely withdrawn, where we are isolated, and where we're lonely. So we have to start designing public space. We have to flip it on its head and start designing public spaces, not as a place of withdrawal to withdraw to, but a place to come to get engaged. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that philosophy of parks, you know, drills down to how you sit in a park. And can you sit in a park that is purposely designed to help you become engaged with someone? And I think that's really important. And I was walking down the streets of Montreal, and I saw two classic, you know, park benches, but they were placed, as you mentioned, like they were placed facing each other, mm-hmm. with only about a 4-foot distance between the two. So if you wanted to sit on a bench on this street, you had to be willing to possibly look somebody else in the eye and, you know, God forbid, start, you know, talking to them. But that's a design philosophy. You know, I have a series of joy principles, and one of them is purpose-built engagement, that we have to start, you know, designing public spaces that's not accidental, is purposely built to engage us and to get us to engage with each other.
When in that subline of the book, you kind of have mid-sized cities. You don't say cities or big cities. Like, I guess it's because much of the experience is from Kitchener-Waterloo, Cambridge, as a conurbation that is not that big. But does that mean you think the mid-sized city has the better ability to be a challenger or to be a joy experiment or to be a place that does this first?
Well, yeah, I mean, that title is there partially because, yes, that was our experience is in mid-sized cities. You know, part of me sometimes says, you know, bigger cities already get this. And sometimes that's true. but you know, where you usually sort of say, oh my God, look, you know, what they did, it's so amazing. It's usually in bigger cities that you see that. And yet mid-sized cities, I think that's where the opportunity is. If we can take 200 mid-sized cities and turn them around to be this way, that's significant. And I think mid-sized cities are where many people are moving to because they can't afford to live in the larger cities. And so that's significant. And there's a whole bunch of cities, at least in North America, like Waterloo region, who are coming out of being in what was called the Rust Belt. You know, their former success was revolved around, you know, industry. And now they're moving to the Brain Belt, where most of their success is in the innovation economy. And they need to find ways of appealing to the talent of the innovation economy. I mean, I think the talent of the innovation economy is the equivalent of what the railroad was back in the 1800s. If your city got the railroad running through it and stopping, your city was on the path to prosperity. If your city didn't get the railroad, your city was just on the path to becoming a ghost town. That might be overly dramatic, but you get the idea.
Or a backwater, at least.
Backwater. The old backwater. I think today, your ability to appeal to the world-class talent that the innovation economy revolves around is that important. Mm-hmm. And so mid-sized cities have to step up to this. I also think that mid-sized cities contain the division in a more salient way. I don't think there's any, you know, I don't think I'm telling anything that no one sort of realizes, that a lot of our division is urban versus rural, or mm-hmm. urban big versus small. And in mid-sized cities, you can feel that very, very, very strongly because the distance between the two is less. And that, to me, that then says, well, this is an opportunity to start the healing. It's at a scale where we can truly bring opposites together more easily and start to find ways of building unifying values for the future.
I like the idea of there's this sort of like a challenger brand, like the thing that's the tier two, the number 2, 3, 4, 5 in a market, the whole Avis, we try harder sort of thing. I think that exists for cities, but I think a lot of those like sort of tier two, tier three cities lost their confidence to do new things. So they're always looking at what other people were doing and trying to pretend and cosplay as the big city. Whereas when those places have been like, we are who we are, let's work with that, that's when they tend to get quite exciting.
Yes, yes. I think there tends to be, in some mid-sized cities, we're not that. We're not a big city. We don't do that. Why? Well, because that's what big cities do. We don't do that. Well, you know, why not? Why can't we sort of start to figure that out? And you're right. Then every so often, a mid-sized city does it, and they can do it in a way that when they start creating a city that's based on play, live, work, as opposed to live, work, play, it catches fire in a way that's stronger because it's happening in a smaller space and it's making a bigger difference to the community. And you know, for the last 35 years, you could point to Austin, Austin, Texas as one of those. Another one that I think right now is happening is Victoria, British Columbia. This past summer, we went to Victoria, and I was really expecting a very sleepy British town full of, you know, old people.
They say it was 10 years ago when I went, they said the city of newlyweds and nearly deads.
Yes. That's a phrase. And, but to me, it was not. It was like every generation was there. There were microbreweries. There were all this action and really interesting stuff, and a very open-minded approach to how to interact and hang out in the city that I was really excited about. And someone told me that, I mean, I don't know how accurate this is, and I may be getting it somewhat wrong, but that the city consciously kind of started targeting, you know, not quite startups, but, you know, tier two or tier three down the road of startups, saying, look, you can set up office anywhere you want. Why not set your office up in some place where your people would really love to live? You know, and you know, Victoria had all this, and it caught on. And so now there's this whole, you know, another layer of energy in that city. So that's an example of another example of how when these changes happen in a mid-sized city, they can create more energy that doesn't get lost in a big giant city.
Yeah.
And I've been told that Fargo is becoming a very cool place.
Oh, cool.
Because Fargo sort of said, you know, we're stuck with this storyline basically coming from the movie and the TV series and whatnot. What if we just started having fun with that? You know, what if we just started sort of goofing around with that? And now it's kind of turning into a very, very interesting place. I don't know much more about it than that, but
we'll have to go check it out.
I don't know whether Montreal is viewed as a, you know, maybe in the global sense, it's viewed as a mid-sized city, but at a national level, it's viewed as some, you know, a large city. But Montreal is very, you know, it's very magical. At times it's very chaotic, but, you know, I think a little bit of chaos is what you need to make magic. So
something I was put onto, I was talking to a guy who works in a mayor's office, and when I said I was moving to Montreal, he's like, you have to read the book Saving the City. I'm going to try and do one of these interviews with the author of it.
Mm.
But I didn't realize that the way Montreal is run as a municipality is different. So you have like the mayor of the city, but then you have the borough mayors. So they have many more people in charge of municipal administration, creates a bit of conflict, but it means that One of the reasons why the plateau is kind of a bit of a poster child of urbanism is because the plateau had its own mayor who was competing almost against the mayor of Rosemont, and the mayor in the plateau had, let's just say, they were very happy to piss some people off in the pursuit of what they saw as greatness. And then other boroughs started to copy the best bits, or they do things themselves and be like, we've done something more interesting than the plateau. So I think it's like a sort of, I wouldn't say Montreal's a mid-sized city, but I think some of the ways it can be administrated and behave feels much more mid-sized. It made me think differently about how do you run a city.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't heard that, and I find that interesting that it can operate sort of at a micro and macro at the same time and make that work for them. And I'm not surprised now that is the case, because you do get this sense of, well, you know, when you say like Montreal, well, which Montreal are you talking about? What part of Montreal? And that's wonderful. Yet at the same time, I think there's something very unified in terms of the community of Montreal. You know, long before Montreal has turned into the place it is now, there is still a behavior that a series of values, you know, there used to be a phrase that in Toronto on Friday, when you got your paycheck, back when you got paychecks, you would run to the bank and deposit it. Whereas in Montreal, if you got your paycheck, you ran to the bistro and you had a good dinner and wine and you had a fun with your friends. And that essence still is Montreal. Mm-hmm. And it is so much, and you say, well, they're French. Well, no, it's not. It's not that.
It's a lot of Anglo still. There's a lot of Anglos have the same behavior.
It is Montreal. And it is Anglo as much as it is French, as much as it is, you know, any other nationality that is there. And religion that is there, it is part of Montreal. And when you have a sense of your community, this is who we are, these are our values being the things you spend your time and your money and your effort on, that helps guide you. And I think Montreal has been able to evolve into what it is and what we've been sort of, you know, talking about, because there's a set of community values, whether they're written down or whether it's just organic, and probably is better that they're organic. They help guide what Montreal. So it's not surprising that Montreal is now sort of, you know, a capital of animation and film, and it's a brilliant place for public space and public art, engaging public art. And it's the home of a company that I have done work with, Daily Tous les Jours, and they're brilliant at their how they create public play. It's not surprising when you consider Montreal always knew how to play. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few places in North America where they actually knew how to play, and that is serving them well.
It's really interesting. I had someone get in touch with me when I did the first series of this, but they're from Bologna. And Bologna is a city I went to last year. I loved it. Mm. But he said Bologna is one of the ultimate challenger cities because it's got, I think it's the world's oldest university. It has a very strong, very left-wing, borderline communist political streak running through it. Mm. And it was always a little bit isolated. And then when they built the high-speed train, you had this thing of Bologna had amazing young talent from the university. It was a very cheap place to live. Great food, very sort of strong social community aspect. It was totally different to Florence. Mm. So you would have people who, and when the train connected, you could have people from Bologna who didn't have to leave Bologna to go work in Florence where the economy was stronger. The reason they could be a challenger was they weren't going, how can we be more like Florence? They were like, no, we are more socialist. We are more academic. How do we turn that into a city that is relevant in the modern era? And I think like each city has its DNA, and like Montreal's very much rooted in play. I think Bologna's is very much rooted in learning. I think there's a really interesting thing of cities like Victoria is one, I think Fredericton and New Brunswick's another, where it's aging. How do we become a great city to grow old in? And if we become a great city to grow old in, the healthcare impact of growing old isn't about the financial burden. It's actually more about like, how do we keep seniors active and playing so that has impacts later down the line?
Yeah, I've been asked to go and give a talk to a city in Florida. I'm not sure they want me to, I don't know whether I should be mentioning the name or not, so I just won't, to be on the safe side.
We'll let people guess.
They are a city that for the last 50 years, it was a place where you went to when you were retiring. But now, given the cost of living in some cities, it started to become a place where you went to when you had kids and lived there with the hope. And some of them were, some of it was like kids who were living there, they left like everyone always does. But now they're coming back and they're saying, no, I'm going to raise my kids here and I want my kids to stay here. And they're kind of faced with the, well, hold on, that's not how our city was designed. There's no infrastructure for what you're trying to do here. And wait a minute, this means we have to stop and have a conversation. What type of community? We can say what type of city do we need to become and figure out, you know, what bike lanes and what are roads and where this should go and the sewage and the plumbing and, you know, should that be a series of apartments and should that be a downtown? They can have that. But they also need to have a conversation about what type of community do we need to become to thrive in the future? And what are the values associated with that community once we define it? Because that's what's scalable. The values, how you describe the community you want to become and the values you would place within that description, that is scalable. That can be applied to all your projects and, you know, whether you should be putting bike lanes here or something else there. You have a series of, no, we shouldn't because we feel this way about what type of community we want to be, or yes, we should. So I think, you know, something that organically grew in Montreal is something that maybe has to be done in a more strategic fashion in some of these other places.
As when you wrote the book, there's like some lovely themes and sort of the chapters you had. I, in my head, I almost had that they were like Paul's kind of principles. Things along the lines of like the street should be free or 50 bright ideas are better than one. As you were sort of pulling that together, what's the one or two things that you just like, that is what people who are thinking about how they change their city, whether they work in the city council or whether they work for a large employer or whether they're just a parent taking their kids to school, what the one, the pieces that the ones you find yourself hammering home the most when you're out talking about what you've learned?
Well, I've already kind of mentioned one, which is changing cities changes the world. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the good news. The bad news is if we're not game for changing cities, we have zero chance of changing the world. So I think we should jump at the chance to change cities. Cities are changeable. Change happens when you change priorities. It's like there is this attitude, well, we'll just keep working harder at what we're doing within the framework of how we do it, and somehow change will happen. No, change happens when you change priorities, and that's why I think the play live work versus live work play is so important. Yeah, it's just a handful of words and we're just moving around, but we're changing the priorities. In the previous model, play was the last thing on the list because it was the last priority. It wasn't even defined. No one even defined what we meant by play. And it was something we spent money on when we had leftover money. And it was usually something that we placed on land that we couldn't do anything else with. And to this day, some cities would say, we don't like to talk play. That's silly. That's frivolous. Well, when you think of play the way I've been talking about it, I don't think it's frivolous at all.
It's a very sad place if that's not taking place.
Yeah. I mean, play is, given that live and work don't necessarily connect like they used to anymore, you have more and more people who can choose where they live, not based on where they work. Their criteria for where they want to live in is very, very different than what it used to be. And people want to, cities that play, that's where people want to go. That's where they want to be. That's where they take vacations. That's where they want to be. Cities that play make belonging and inclusiveness tangible because they create physical spaces for that to be. And those physical spaces become physical artifacts of their culture and of their community. They create the places where people feel they have emotional ownership of their city. Regardless of whether they can afford to own a house or not, they have emotional ownership of their city. So these things are really, really important. So I kind of say that what I'm talking about is these places are spaces of collective joy, the type of joy that you experience when you're connected to others or something bigger than yourself, where you feel you belong in something positive. And I'm not talking about joy as a reward for having a great life. You know, I got a great car, I got a great house, I got this and I got that. And so, of course, do I feel joy? Yeah, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about joy as a tool of resilience to get us all to a better place. You know, people sort of often say to me, you know, Paul, you know, joy, that's great. You know, get it. You found a word that nobody can argue against. But really, we have to meet people's basic needs. People have to have their basic needs met before they can absorb the concept of joy and apply it to their own lives. Hierarchy of need. And I pushed back on that a lot because I would say that the hierarchy of need would suggest that Southern gospel music, the most joyful sound I know, that can only be can only happen when a group of people come together and express their feelings. Southern gospel music should never have come out of a society of slavery, violence, and poverty. Should never have happened. It did. And not only did it, it was instrumental in that community developing the resilience to carry on and thrive and overcome. So joy, in one of the key messages I sort of pound away at, joy is practical. I believe it's the last words in the book, and they're printed very largely on the back. Joy is practical. And if you say play, live, work is the new priority, then joy is a practical city building objective. We will not solve the problems we have in this world by using grim determination to tackle grim problems. If we double down on grim, people will feel society is failing and they'll just pull up the ladder and say, screw it, I'm done, I'm out. We need joy as part of our path for resilience. We need joy to make cities stronger. That's how we change the world. That's usually what I pound away at people with.
I almost want to end on that, but I have one last question for you, Paul. Actually, I have two last questions for you. So,
okay.
What I got a lot when I did the first series was people messaging me going, I'm a senior marketing manager in a company, or I'm currently unemployed, or I'm not in a position of power. What can I do? I love what these people are saying, but what can I do? And I feel like there's a lot that people can do. It doesn't have to be like go and become a property developer and put a great big amazing art installation into it and you'll create joy. I think there's other ways that can just be small little behaviors. But what would you say to people that are thinking, but what can I do when it comes to changing the world through changing our cities?
Well, there's a couple. I guess I would take it down to the very, very small level and say, start demanding and start asking for and start participating with your community to have joy and play being more part of it. And when there are moments like that in your city, and most cities have them in some way, shape, or form, use them. Get out there and experience the joy and create the joy, you know. And, you know, most of our city halls are full of people who are terrified of making a mistake because citizens scream and yell at them. And, you know, every time they spend $35 on a bicycle rack, everybody goes crazy and wants, don't spend my tax dollars this way. Tell city how you know, like tell city, I would pay more money in taxes if I was able to have X, Y, and Z. Now they need support in making their decisions, but all they ever hear are complaints. So tell people what you would love to have your city, you know, do, and invest in, and participate in the joy that is in your city. Turn your cell phones off. This is coming from a guy who spent 10 years bringing that technology to the world. Turn your cell phones off. Go to the park. You know, don't sit in your backyard with your 8-foot-high fence. Go to a public space and experience it. And then start realizing that maybe we could benefit from more of this stuff, more ways of interacting. Doesn't always have to be public space. There's lots of different ways. Maybe there should be more clubs. Maybe there should be, you know, something else. These are things we can all do. I would be, you know, shocked if the city, whoever's listening, I would be shocked if your city didn't have places of joy, of collective joy, places that really start to define a sense of community where you can actually come away with a tingle down your spine because you feel you're part of a community for once. They have them. Go use them. And then celebrate them and let the officials of your city know that you value this.
And then make them even better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So last question for you, Paul. I like to ask the people in the previous series, more focused on Toronto, if they had a magic wand and could do a thing to Toronto, what would they do with it? You live in Kitchener. If you had a magic wand to do something that was joy related, or to make a city more joyful, whether that's Kitchener, whether it's Toronto, whether it's Fargo, what would you do with your magic wand?
Maybe I'd make them all more like Fargo. I don't know. But I don't really know. I don't quite know.
Outdoor Fargo screenings.
Well, you know, Toronto is. I've lived in Toronto many times in my life. I think Toronto is a city of neighborhoods, and it's like, and I love that about Toronto. And there's sort of it's not maybe a global city, but it's a global town kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's just all these neighborhoods with different ethnic things, and I love all that. But there's something about how Toronto doesn't knit itself together physically that I just, And there's two examples of it. One, the waterfront is, when you go to Chicago and you experience that waterfront, and then you experience Toronto waterfront. It's like, oof, Toronto's waterfront is full of barriers. And there's something about Toronto, whenever they do public space, it's like in a, it's defined by this space or that space or this area. And if we could start to define public space in a more organic fashion. And I'm going to give an example where I think that's already happening and I think it's brilliant, but I'm going to first give an example where it's always been there and Toronto doesn't really make it part of who they are. And that's all the ravines in Toronto. I think Toronto should promote itself as the city of ravines. Like if you walk the Rosedale Ravine or some of the other ravines in Toronto, and the parks that are there and just the little neighborhoods that kind of pop out. Toronto's, and you can start in one part of Toronto and end up in another, and the whole time you're kind of almost like submerged 30 feet below the city in this ravine, walking and seeing. To me, it's such an amazing way to connect the city. Mm-hmm. That they don't, but Toronto kind of, it's there, but Toronto just doesn't really sort of get behind it and say, this is, we are the city of ravines, and to make a huge deal about walking these and riding these ravines in a, not only as a way, okay, well, I'm going to go and hang out with trees for a while, but as a way of getting from one place to another, as a way of connecting communities and finding ways to, for communities to meet in these ravines, I think it would be amazing. Now, where I think they're actually doing that is the Bentway in Toronto. Mm-hmm. I've had the pleasure of knowing and working with some of the people involved there, and Ken Greenberg especially, who was instrumental in that happening. And it's one of the few, like, first of all, you take a piece of the most useless land underneath the Gardiner Expressway. Can you imagine turning that into something beautiful? And they did it. But more importantly, they connected neighborhoods. The Gardiner Expressway was like a kind of a moat, you know, plus mm-hmm. a Berlin Wall all in one, separating people, you know, separating the people that were living down on Queens Quay from the people who were living up on Bathurst, and, you know, and then for the people that were just to the west of it. And it created a place where they could come and actually engage with each other. And now there are plans to extend the Bentway, like right across the southern part of Toronto, with each little area funded slightly different, with a different partnership of private and public partnerships, each area sort of taking on a slightly different character. And to me, that's like learning what nature did in the ravines and now applying it to, mm-hmm. to public spaces. And, you know, the first chunk of the Bentway was very sort of community built in terms of, It was very community built in terms of partnerships, in terms of, you know, what type of programming happens there, working with some of the clubs and agencies in the area to allow certain activities to happen in the Bentway. I think if they continue on with that plan, it's more than just a cool way to use crappy land. It's the type of space we need, where it sort of meanders through the city and becomes many different things at many different times. Something like similar to the Rose Kennedy Parkway, I think it's called, in Boston. Mm-hmm. That sort of meanders through the city, and depending on what part you're in, it sort of characterizes itself based on the neighborhood.
There's bits of Sao Paulo that, like, they have highways all over that city. Like, traffic is insane. But they turn lots of it into public art spaces and places for people to hang out, play basketball. And it's like, as a tourist, it's a nice place to go see. As a local, it's almost like having a second living room of the city. So, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I think cities should become people's living rooms or people's backyards. A city should be, you should look at your city as your backyard. A city should make you happy. A city should make you feel like you belong to something. Because the collective human spirit of a city is its strongest social and economic attribute. Mm-hmm. And the invention of new ideas and that comes out of the collaboration of that is the most important output of cities. You know, throughout history, all the new ideas, all the new ways of, you know, the arts, invention, the humanities, all of that stuff comes out of densely populated cities, always has, always will. And we tend to, I think we're treating cities like they're this is where I get my basic needs met, mm-hmm. and keep the costs low, like they're survival camps. And we need more than that now.
It's like a suffocation of the collective intelligence of a city when you, it's basic needs first and not necessarily thinking about the other things that actually give a city oxygen. That's how I see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I, you know, despite all the division and despite all the news, I think at a, when you pull yourself out of the national, you know, winds that blow and you can find time to pull yourself away from the efficiencies of the internet and social media, I think most people are pretty tired of it. They just don't know how to get out of it.
Yeah.
I think most people want to belong to a physical space and a physical community that gets along. People are worn out of this game of, you know, the individual is everything and push it to the limits. I think people are starting to go, no, I just need to feel like there is, I need a way of tangibly forming optimism, and I need a language for optimism.
Well, here's to be optimistic.
I think, you know, buried within the book, The Joy Experiments, and some of the beliefs of New Urbanism in general, there is trying to build the language and the space for optimism.
I think when there's people like yourself writing books like you've written and graciously giving up your time to talk to people like me on these kind of things, I'm optimistic for the future. We have to be. But you're making a difference. So, Paul, thank you so much for having the time to chat with me today.
Well, thank you. I mean, I really do appreciate your interest in this, and hopefully the interest of the people who are listening. Sort of a thank you before you even hear. Thank you for paying attention and listening to it. Thank you in advance to everybody out there for all the great stuff that you're going to do, including buying the book, The Joy Experiments, available at, you can find out where you can buy this at www.thejoyexperiments.com. Yes, that's thejoyexperiments.com.
And you will notice a significant bump in your royalties as this thing goes out.
Well, hopefully, even though the book is on everyone's coffee table, the question is it on your nightstand? Yes, folks, it's got to be on your nightstand.
We're just ready for a sequel, that's all.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Thank you so much for listening to what has been the first of many more episodes of the Challenger City podcast. And we'll see you for another one very, very soon. Thank you. Goodbye.